Thank you. After that introduction, I'm rather curious to hear what I'm going to say. We're going to talk tonight about critical theory. Now, this is sometimes called cultural Marxism. There are a number of other terms that are used for it. You've probably heard of critical race theory in connection with Black Lives Matter. But critical race theory is only one small part, well, maybe not so small, but only one part of a much bigger problem. And that's what we'll be looking at. Now, in terms of the way we're going to be doing this, tonight is going to be theory. You need to understand where these ideas come from and what the ideas are that are informing things like the Black Lives Matter movement, the LGBTQ plus movement, a wide range of other things. So tonight we're going to be, the two talks will be looking at the background, the ideas behind these things. Tomorrow morning, the first talk will look at, in a bit more detail, at a few of the ways this works out in practice, particularly with critical race theory and LGBTQ stuff. And then the second talk will be how, as Christians, we should be responding to this. So that's the overview of what we're going to be doing. Now, this means that a lot of this tonight is going to be a bit theoretical, and I would apologize for that, but I can't, because you really need to understand this stuff. So let's get started. Now, when we talk about critical theory, like I said, it's frequently referred to as cultural Marxism, we need to understand what that means. And that really starts with a 19th century philosopher by the name of Hegel. And Hegel's thought is really complicated, and it gets really abstract really fast. When I tried to talk through this with my wife this afternoon, she quickly said, you can't get into that. So what we're going to do here is just focus on one part of Hegel's theory. Hegel believed that history moved forward in discrete periods. In other words, there was one period, that period ended, then another period began. And then that period ended, and another period began. Okay. Now, this isn't really the way history works. I'm a historian, trust me. I'm a professional. It's not like somebody woke up on January 1st, 1400, as a stonecutter in Florence, and said to the guy next to him, hey, Luigi, did you know that the Renaissance began? And Luigi says, oh, the Renaissance already? Gee, just yesterday it seemed like the Middle Ages. That's not how it works. Okay. But Hegel thought that that was more or less the way it really worked. And he believed that the historical process moved forward in an evolutionary way. Basically, you know, he's before Darwin, but he still believes that the universal spirit, he's a pantheist, okay? He believes there's a universal spirit that governs everything. It's called the Geist. You see the word there? The German word Geist, spirit, ghost, okay? There's this universal spirit that governs everything, and this universal spirit is constantly improving, constantly growing on the basis of reason and freedom. And so the different periods of history are characterized by increasing freedom. Okay? This is the way it works. And he believed that the ultimate expression of perfect freedom was found in early 19th century Prussia, which happened to be where he was from. We're not even going to get into Prussia. It turns out that although Hegel himself didn't use this, Hegel's ideas were articulated in a lot of ways by Johann Fichte. That's the guy on the left. Hegel's on the right here. Fichte created a way of explaining the way history moves forward. What he said is that each period of history had its own principle that governed it. This was called the thesis. However, this principle didn't work perfectly. There were certain things that, well, contradictions that came up in it. You know, some people had freedom and others didn't. So this created a counter movement called an antithesis. Okay? And then eventually there's a kind of revolution that will occur that creates a synthesis that combines parts of the thesis and the antithesis together. And this became known as a Hegelian dialectic, even though, like I said, Hegel knew about this but never used it. But nonetheless, this is what gets associated with Hegel's thing. Now, the reason why you need to know that is because of that guy. Karl Marx. And no, I didn't grow my beard to look like him. Marx was initially part of a group called the Young Hegelians. And the Young Hegelians were people who accepted Hegel's ideas, kind of, but they disagreed with certain key points. They believed in this idea that history moves forward by this dialectical process, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. But they rejected Prussia as the end of history. They said, you know, this state is not anything close to perfect. And so what they decided they needed to do was to find a way to undermine Prussia, to knock Prussia off this Hegelian peak. And so to do that, they decided to go after Christianity. Because Prussia was a Lutheran state. And the Lutheranism in Prussia and the state were really, really deeply intertwined. So they figured if you take out religion, if you take out Christianity, you undermine Prussia. So that was really the goal of the Young Hegelians. Now, Marx starts with them, but ultimately he breaks. He separates from the Young Hegelians because he says that this idea of, well, Marx is a materialist. He believes that the only thing that exists is matter and energy. This idea of a Geist or a spirit of the age, whatever it's that, you know, that's nothing. The thing that moves history forward is capital, which he defined as surplus wealth. That was the basis of society, and that was the thing that moved society forward. Who has capital? And the Hegelian dialectic applies in that, in different periods of history, capital moves. Different groups get it. And actually, the number of people who have access to it sort of expands. So for Marx, everything is economic. Everything is really determined by economics. And history does move forward in these discrete periods. It is moving in a direction. There is a right side of history. It is moving in a specific direction. And inevitably, sooner or later, the proletariat, which is his term for the urban working classes, the people, the factory workers, things like that, would rise up, take control of the means of production, they'll take over the factories, and then the owners and the workers will be the same people and you'll reach a communist state, utopia. This is inevitable, history will go this way. That's Marx's theory. Now, what this means is, since he's an economic determinist, since he believes that everything is economics, cultures, religion, all of these kinds of things are nothing more than, well, technical term, epiphenomena. There are things that accompany economic systems. So, Christianity, the Protestant Reformation, was the religion that supported the ideology of the emerging bourgeois class. And that's all that it is. When the bourgeois class ceases to have power, Christianity will vanish. Because it will no longer be the ideology that's needed. So going after the ideology is sort of like treating a symptom, not the disease. That's Marx's basic idea. Now, this turns into a much larger movement, what we can call classical Marxism. Classical Marxism is based on, obviously, on Marx's ideas. And what it really is a secular myth. The universe is self-created. Everything in the universe evolves, including societies, things like that, by this dialectical process. History moves from one phase to the next, to the next, to the next. The basic problem that we have in society throughout history is economic oppression. Some people own others' work. The owners get all the profits, the workers get nothing. That's the fundamental reality, according to Marx, of history. And your class really was your identity. Whatever class you belonged to, that was the sum total of your identity, according to Marx. Now, like I said, the inevitable solution here is going to be the proletariat revolution, which will then create a classless society. Everybody will be simultaneously an owner and a worker. That's pure Marxism. This gets modified by a guy named Lenin. That's Vladimir, not John. And Vladimir Lenin says that it's not just the proletariat, the urban workers, it's the urban workers and the peasants uniting together. Because Russia was dominated by peasants, if we're going to have a communist revolution in Russia, you had to include them. Okay. So that's what creates Marxist-Leninism, which is the ideology of the Soviet Union. The symbol of the Soviet Union, the hammer and sickle, the hammer represents the factory worker, the sickle represents the farmer, the peasant. That then gets further modified by a guy named Mao in China, who basically throws out the proletariat and says it's a peasant uprising, because China was even more dominated by peasants and wasn't particularly industrialized. So if you're going to have a communist revolution there, it's got to be a peasant revolution. So you get these modifications on classical Marxism, but all of them have one thing in common. They're all based on the idea that it's economics that drives everything, that the basic problem is economic oppression. Now, this raised another question for this guy. That's Antonio Gramsci. Gramsci was an Italian communist living between World Wars I and II. And the question that Gramsci asked is, why hasn't the revolution occurred? We should have had, the proletariat should have risen by now. Why hasn't it happened? And functionally, why did Marxism fail? What Gramsci said is, okay, Marx was right. The world is divided up ultimately between oppressors and the oppressed. The problem is that the oppressed, and the oppressed now is a much broader category. It's not just the economically oppressed, but there are all kinds of other people who are oppressed too. And the problem is they don't know it. They don't even recognize the fact that they're oppressed. And the reason they don't recognize their oppression is because that they've bought into the dominant ideology of the culture. He called this the hegemony. So they bought into the dominant ideology of the culture. They bought into, they're suffering from the Stockholm Syndrome. They bought into the ideology of their oppressors, so much so that they don't even realize that they're being oppressed. And this ideology, this hegemony, is enforced by the institutions of society. Education, government, all of these kinds of institutions exist basically to protect the classes that have power. That's all that it is. Institutions exist to protect and promulgate those ideas. Okay. Now, his solution to this, this is where he's going to move away from Marx, and this is why we talk about cultural Marxism. His solution is to develop an alternative worldview, an alternative culture. He called that the counter-hegemony. And he said that this would come up through a union of intellectuals, people who actually understand the problem, and the workers who experience the problem. They would unite together to create this counter-hegemony, an alternative ideology of culture. And then this would be the thing that would propel us toward the ultimate communist revolution. And in order to do this, you have to create the counter-hegemony, but you also have to begin infiltrating the institutions in society so that you can seed this idea into them so that over time it will grow and then you'll be able to take over. That's Gramsci's basic idea. Gramsci's ideas were picked up by the Institute for Social Research at the University of Frankfurt in Germany. This is therefore usually simply referred to as the Frankfurt School. It was founded by a communist by the name of Karl Grunberg back in 1923. When Hitler came to power, the institute moved from the University of Frankfurt to Geneva in 1933, and then 2 years later, Columbia University invited them to the United States. And thus the Frankfurt School got itself well established over here. They've got a lot of influences. You see some of them there. Kant, I didn't say much about him. Actually, I didn't say anything about him, but we'll leave him alone for now. Hegel, Karl Marx, and well, Sigmund Freud. You're going to be seeing Freud coming in spades tomorrow. Now, the Frankfurt School was at the foundation of something called the New Left. And those of us who remember the 60s, which means we were too young to really be there, and the 70s, will probably, may have encountered the New Left. And the New Left's program is really outlined here. The they believe that people, this is again coming out of Gramsci, where people bind into the hegemony. People had a false consciousness. They did not really understand the fact that they were oppressed. They did not really understand the forces that were arrayed against them, that brainwashed them into accepting a situation that was frankly unacceptable. So people were suffering from this false consciousness. As a result, in order to fix this, it was necessary to raise people's consciousness. So you go from false consciousness to raising consciousness. And this is, the means for doing this is to make them aware of their oppression. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to make them realize how the system that they're living in and that they bought into has sold them a bill of goods, that it's been a raw deal. And that, in fact, the culture is treating them like tools and fools. Once their consciousness is raised, the next step is to move to class consciousness. And class consciousness means you recognize the oppressed group that you are a part of. If you're a woman, you want to join the feminist movement. If you're an African American, you've got Black Power, and so on. This leads you directly into group or identity politics. And the great goal, actually, is to create a coalition of grievance groups. A coalition of groups who've had their consciousness raised so that so that they can actually unite together to overthrow the system. Now, tactics. How were they going to go about doing this? Well, a guy named Rudy Dutschke there in 1967, he's the one on the left, coined the phrase, the long march through the institutions. The term long march comes from Mao Zedong. When he finally took over China, it was at the end of, quote, the long march, where he literally marched physically his guys across China and took it over. Well, what Dutschke said is that following Mao's example, we need our own version of a long march, although this time it's going to be a long march through the institutions, picking up on Gramsci's idea that institutions are the things that keep the people in power. So if you want to get rid of the people in power, if you want to change the system, you got to do it by getting into the institutions. And we're going to play a long game here, because we're not going to be able to step in and instantly change everything. So what we're going to do is we're going to gradually infiltrate the institutions and gradually shift them over to our way of thinking. They're playing a very, very long game here. Now, Herbert Marcuse, the guy on the right, key member of the Frankfurt School, Marcuse picked up on this term in his book, Counter-Revolution and Revolt, published in 1972. He's going to popularize this term, Long March of the Institutions. A lot of people think it comes from him. He actually stole it from Dutschke. And but we acknowledge it, so I suppose it's not really stealing. In any event, he's going to push this idea as the key strategy for the new left to raise people's consciousness and to move toward ultimately a communist state. His focus was on the media. He believed that the key place that the new left needed to work was to get control of the media. Because if they had the media, he thought they would have the culture. He thought that would come with it. Now, he's not the only one who's thinking this way. Another member of the Frankfurt School, Max Horkheimer here, this was his statement. The revolution won't happen with guns. Rather, it will happen incrementally, year by year, generation by generation. That's the long march. We will gradually infiltrate their educational institutions and their political offices, transforming them slowly into Marxist entities as we move toward universal egalitarianism. He's telling you right there what they're going to do. You combine these two things, what you see is they're going after control of the media, which includes news, by the way, news and entertainment, all of that stuff. Actually, there's very little distinction between the two now. So you're going to go after the media. Yeah, that was my outside voice, wasn't it? Okay, anyway, you're going to go after the media, you're going to go after the schools, and you're going to go after political office. In other words, they're going after the key levers that move society, the key levers that move culture. This is all the way back in the early 70s. And what has happened is you have New Left teachers in the universities who teach the next generation of school teachers. Those school teachers teach the kids, they grow up in it. Eventually, they're in the faculty as well, at the universities. And we've got generation after generation after generation by this point of teachers, particularly at the university level, but over time, even at the level of the public schools, who are pushing this agenda. We see it happening through the media. We see it happening increasingly in politics. This is the long march of work. Now, that's one of the tactics that the New Left advocates. There are a variety of them. The other one that I think is particularly important is the idea of repressive tolerance. Repressive tolerance comes once again from our friend Herbert Markham's. He argued that it was important for people to tolerate ideas coming from the left, but not the right. Because after all, the right, well, they were evil, they were the ones who controlled society and all of that, and we have to do everything in our power to suppress them while we were pushing ideas from the left. This includes, by the way, this goes up to and including violence. We can justify violence from the left, we always condemn violence from the right. I want you to think about the last year. Okay, so repressive tolerance is supposed to show up in education. You teach ideas from the left and you do not allow ideas from the right to be taught. It is to be done through systematic indoctrination and at me with violence. This is Mark Pease's idea. Now, I got a long quote for you. I'm going to read this thing through and we'll break it up as we go along. I want you to catch what he is saying here. Repressive tolerance would include a number of measures. They would include the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements which promote, well, his list of right-wing programs. Any kind of aggressive policies, armament, chauvinism, discrimination on the grounds of race or religion, or which oppose the extension of public services, Social Security, Medicare, etc. He would add immigration today. You don't allow anyone to advocate for any of these things. You do not allow freedom of assembly to support any of these things. Repressive toleration. Moreover, the restoration of freedom of thought, note the phrase freedom of thought, a key point that you need to note for advertisers and other propagandists is that what they do is they use a word that carries good emotional feelings, but they redefine it out of all recognition of what it really means. So he's talking about freedom of thought. Who opposes freedom of thought? But listen to what he says freedom of thought involves. Moreover, the restoration of freedom of thought, meaning there wasn't any before this, may necessitate new and rigid restrictions, freedom of thought with restrictions, on teachings and practices in the educational institutions which, by their very methods and concepts, serve to enclose the mind within the established universe of discourse and behavior. What that means is anything that supports what he would consider the status quo, anything that supports right-wing policies, anything that supports traditional American ideas about values, about freedom, about all of these things, all of that has to be rigidly suppressed, because otherwise they would preclude a priori a rational evaluation of the alternatives. In other words, if you tell them things about the system, if you teach them about the system, they will not be able to have a, quote, rational evaluation of the alternatives. You can't present both of them. You can only present one, because if you present the other, they're never going to be able to evaluate it correctly. Okay, quick question for those of you in the room. How many of you, when you were in school, had any kind of instruction about Marxism? I learned all about Marxism in school. How many of you had instruction, I'm talking elementary school, high school, how many of you had instruction on free market economics? That's actually more than I expected, but you will note that there were a lot more Marxists than free market people. That's what this is about. And to the degree which, and to the degree to which freedom of thought involves the struggle against inhumanity, restoration of such freedom should also imply intolerance toward scientific research in the interest of deadly, quote, deterrence of abnormal human endurance under inhuman conditions, and so on. He's writing this during the Vietnam War. So anything that supports the military, you have to ban any kind of scientific work in that area in the name of freedom of thought. That, my friends, is cultural Marxism. So let's summarize key points. First of all, any worldview that divides the world into heroes and villains, into oppressors and oppressed, ultimately derives from Marxism, and actually earlier from Hegel. Anytime you see people arguing that way, you are almost inevitably, there are a few exceptions, but almost inevitably, you are looking at a Marxist influence thing. Now, I have to clarify this a little bit. When we're talking about groups, this group is good, this group is evil. This group are the heroes, this group are the villains. That's really the Marxist thing. Okay. Secondly, cultural Marxism focuses on the cultural, quote, hegemony. That is to say, the cultural domination by the people in power and their worldview. That's the focus. The goal is to raise the awareness of the people who are oppressed, to make them aware of their oppression. Oddly enough, this typically no longer includes the poor. It's other kinds of identity groups. It doesn't really include the poor. You're not going to find anybody from a cultural Marxist perspective going to bat for coal miners in Appalachia. It's not about economics anymore. Focus on group identity, and the goal is to unite all these various oppressed groups against the system, against the hegemony. And the strategy, first, control the levers of culture, and second, suppress dissent. That is a thumbnail sketch of what I would refer to as cultural Marxism. Now, technically, we aren't fully at critical theory yet. To get to critical theory, we're going to have to include a few other things. We're going to have to include ideas drawn from a movement called postmodernism. And postmodernism is, frankly, difficult and confusing stuff. That's going to be our next talk. But before I get there, Dick had asked me to give you a quick description of the books that I've written that are over on the book table. So this is the shameless advertising section for this talk. So I'm going to start with this one, Why You Think the Way You Do. I wrote this one really at the request of Chuck Colson and the Colson Fellows, then known as the Centurions. It's a history of the Western world done through the lens of changing worldview. And what you will see here is a summary of the impact of Christianity and the consequences of losing it as a driving force of the culture. Okay. Second in order I've got here, this is my most recent book. It's called Flaying Leviathan. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Thomas Hobbes, he wrote a book called Leviathan, which was a defense of absolutist government. This is a complete violation of everything that the Christian political tradition has taught through the centuries. And what I do in here is talk about how Christian thinking on politics has undermined this idea of absolutist totalitarian government, literally going back to the early church. There are a whole bunch of separate developments that occur in Christian political theology that eventually are brought together into a single system by a guy named John Locke, who then in turn influences the American founders. So that's all traced out in this book. A Brief Introduction to the Reformation, formerly known as the Reformation for Armchair Theologians. This is a brief history of the Reformation. Okay, that's my my area of academic specialty. And the one thing I will say about it is that the Armchair Theologian had the great benefit of having cartoons in it. This one doesn't, but it does include my snide comments about pretty much everybody in the Reformation. So, Okay, now the last one is a kind of unusual book for me. It's called The Kingdom Unleashed. I co-wrote this with a missiologist by the name of Jerry Trousdale. What you are probably not aware of right now is that Christianity is growing faster now than it ever has at any time in human history. Do you know what country Christianity is growing the fastest by proportion is? Iran. It's also growing at an incredible rate in China. The Chinese government is really worried because it looks like by 2030 they're going to have 300 million Christians in China. That's approximately the population of the United States. So, why is it happening in what today is known as the Global South? Africa, Latin America, Asia, places like that. But it's not happening in Europe or North America or Australia. Why is that? Well, what we do in this, Jerry is a missiologist. He knows what's going on overseas, all of the things that are happening, and how and why that's happening. I do a lot of stuff with cultural analysis in the West, and so we've sort of teamed up to do this. It analyzes basically where there is serious spiritual mispractice in the West, in Western churches, including American evangelical churches. What we can learn from our brothers and sisters in the Global South, and how we can turn things around. So that's what this book is about. So I was supposed to go to 8, but I'm a little bit early. I guess I could have done more with Engel, but we'll take a break here.
Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. This particular book, which I've read twice, I'm getting started on it. Not because it's hard to understand, but because it's such a great, if you want an understanding of what worldview and Christian worldview is, there's two books I would recommend that you start with. Why You Think the Way You Do, and Nancy Piercy's Total Truth. If you have not read those two books, go back and read them. And while I'm on my hobby horse, if you've not read Money, Greed, and God, You're Not Saved. Serious about that, because that ties into what we're really talking about in terms of cultural Marxism. Because he's going to be our next speaker, by the way. If you don't understand, there's a reason why half of the millennials are pro-Marxist. Because they don't understand capitalism. We don't teach it. So, get those two books, read them. I should mention to you too, I know it's late, I should have done it before, but we're attempting to film this. So, don't do what I did and walk down the middle aisle. The PowerPoints and the audios, for sure, will be on our website. And Brian, in the back, is going to do that, and I can't tell you exactly when. We're also going to try and put the films up. So, this is an experiment. You're part of the experiment. We're going to give you 10 minutes, and then we're starting without you. So, come back.